Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody! Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature. My name is Jason. We have a lot to talk about this week before getting to the episode itself. Nathan Skreslet from Pixel Who is going to join us to talk about his business and the novelization of The Savages, a fair to middling William Hartnell story from the very end of William Hartnell's TV run in the middle of the year 1966. Talking about podcast news and then Doctor Who news. Happy to announce from Chartable that we are number 4 among all science fiction podcasts in New Zealand. Thank you so much to Paul Schoons and all of my other New Zealand-based listeners. This is the best ranking that I've achieved yet. We can do it, guys. We can get me higher in the science fiction podcast rankings the world over. Michael Storm, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago for the well-received episode 106, Mark of the Rani, has done a blog post about his appearance on the show and about the show himself for his blog, which ties into his forthcoming podcast, Side Rat Storm. That's S-I-D-R-A-T Storm. And I will post a link to that blog post in the show notes. I was recently listening to a two-month-old episode of Gallifrey's Most Wanted, with Ross, who's been on this program several times, and Melvin, who has not, because I reached a point where I had the show booked a year in advance, and I don't have a lot of last-minute openings. Melvin is somebody I definitely want to speak to. He has been on several episodes of Trap 1 and Gallifrey's Most Wanted, although none that I've been on at the same time. My podcast backlog is up to about 7 or 8 weeks behind schedule, so I only just heard their joint GMW episode on the King's Demons. And coincidentally, I reached that in my queue the day after last week's Doctor Who Literature episode dropped, my episode 107, The King's Demons, with Jim Sangster. Melvin does pay tribute on GMW to all of the different song parodies that we have on this show, and those are all the brainchild and genius of Jim Sangster, but he also references a version of the King's Demons song that I did. This was several years ago when I did a guest spot on the Nymon Be Praised podcast, which I believe is now sadly defunct. I have not seen that in my podcast aggregator in a long time. But I did an episode on that show. This would have been in the height of the pandemic, going through season 20, story by story, with me taking on the role of Defender for the most part. I did record a special version of the King's song from the King's Demons on my keyboard for that podcast only. Unfortunately, I no longer have that audio file, but Melvin does seem to have heard it and references it in the GMW episode. I will put a link to that in the show notes as well. Terrific episode. Great work, as always, by Ross and by Melvin. Speaking of Ian Stewart Black, I learned recently that a couple of days ago, as I record this in mid to late March, would have been Ian Stewart Black's 109th birthday. Happy birthday, Ian. In a couple of years, you'll be 111. Ian sadly passed away in 1997 at the ripe old age of 82. I don't consider that passing away. That's more like graduating. But we still recall him very much so in the Doctor Who universe. So yes, we are still counting the years for him. As you're aware, this podcast is now also available on YouTube as well as on your podcast apps of choice. And I am starting to get some great YouTube comments with regard to my back catalog. I will read off a couple of those for you now. A user going by the name of Funny Panda writes for episode 30, The Dalek Invasion of Earth, Jason's breakdown of Terrence Dick's novelization of the Dalek invasion of Earth in the first half of the program was truly eye-opening. Discovering the surprising changes Dick's made to the original story shed new light on one of Doctor Who's most iconic hours. But the real highlight came when Jason was joined by John Peel, a master of Dalek literature himself. It's incredible to see how Doctor Who has evolved over the years, and discussions like these remind us of the legacy of this beloved series. And we also have a comment on episode 104, Galaxy 4, by the same user. Love tuning in for these live interviews straight from Gallifrey 1. It's like being right there in Los Angeles, soaking up all the Doctor Who goodness. Stacey Smith's insights are always a highlight, and delving into some underrated 1960s episodes sounds like a treat. And yes, this episode, The Savages, is also the possibly underrated 1960s episode. Hope you enjoy this one as much as the Galaxy 4 episode. And lastly, the same user weighs in for episode 105A, Turlough and the Earthling Dilemma, which I recorded a few weeks ago with the great Dale Smith. Funny Panda writes, "Wow, what a fantastic episode. The exploration of Doctor Who literature is always a treat, and diving into the Time Lash novelization and the debut of the Companions of Doctor Who line was truly fascinating. Turlough and the Earthling Dilemma being the first original Doctor Who novel adds a whole new dimension to the Hooniverse. Dale Smith's breakdown was insightful and added much depth to the discussion. Great assessment by the host, Jason." And that's Funny Panda on YouTube at 1960 Mookies, M-O-O-K-I-E-S. I am not in the way of knowing if that is a reference to one of my favorite New York Mets baseball players of all time, Mookie Wilson, but stay tuned next week to hear about Mookie Wilson. By the way, there used to be a crossover Star Wars New York Mets podcast called I'd Just As Soon Kiss a Mookie, but unfortunately that also appears to be defunct. And no, I am not making that title up. That is very much a real thing. And we have a few more reviews from that same user as well on my New Year's Day episode with Mark from Trap 1 and on my episode 101A and 101B with Jim Sangster talking about the Gunfighters, and one more for episode 100, The Two Doctors. This one I will read out. Exciting times for Doctor Who fans with Target Book 100. The Two Doctors holds a special place in many hearts, and having Conrad Fraser and Jason Davis back to dissect this iconic story is fantastic news. Patrick Troughton's final live contribution to Doctor Who makes it even more poignant. Can't wait to hear their insights on whether the novelization lives up to the brilliance of the original. Thanks again for such terrific comments, and hopefully more of you will join in the conversation on YouTube. But speaking of conversation, on the other side of the break, Nathan Skreslet from Pixel Who will join me for the first time. We will discuss the business, the art, and then we'll discuss Doctor Who, The Savages by Ian Stuart Black, followed by my review of the novelization. But I must point out, of course, there's been a lot of actual live Doctor Who news with the release of Shu-Dee-Gatwa's first season less than 2 months away. A new 2-minute trailer dropped this week. It looks very fun and bright and colorful and engaging. This trailer does not really give a hint of the emotional content of this coming season, of which I'm sure there is going to be a lot of darkness and scary times, but it is a great way of whetting the appetite. And there's even a snippet from David Bowie, which is one reason why I'm not playing the audio from the trailer on this show. That is one particular bit of copyright infringement of which I do not wish to run afoul. There was also the official news this week of what is possibly the worst kept secret of the last 12 months, that Stephen Moffat himself is coming back to write an episode. When that episode airs, you can be sure that we'll be discussing it over on Trap 1 and also right here on Doctor Who Literature. So for this week, The Savages, let's get to it.
Traveling the Vortex. Are you ready to embark on an epic journey through time and space? Join the thousands of Whovians around the world who've discovered Traveling the Vortex, the ultimate Doctor Who podcast for diehard fans and curious newcomers alike.
Every week, we dive deep into the Whoniverse, discussing the episodes, theories, and hidden gems. We dissect the Doctor's adventures, share behind-the-scenes stories, and explore the legacy of this iconic show.
Traveling the Vortex brings fans together, fostering a global community of Whovians. Whether you're a fan of classic or new Who, there's something for everyone.
Join us on this incredible journey as we unravel the mysteries of time and space.
Don't miss out. Subscribe to Traveling the Vortex today on your favorite podcast platform.
Traveling the Vortex. Your ticket to adventure awaits.
Traveling the Vortex is a proud member of the Direction Point Podcast Network. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Keep turning the pages.
So joining me today as a first-time guest, even though I've known him for years, it's Nathan Skreslet from Pixel Who. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Really pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
I have known you for a very long time on the convention circuit. There's usually a convention that I go – well, I'll say that again. There's never a convention I go to unless you are there with Lee and the Pixel Who booth, up to and including New York Comic Con. So for the uninitiated, my target book of the week has one of your bookmarks inside of it. But what is Pixel Who and how long has it been around?
Oh, gosh. So Pixel Who is kind of an original art project. We do sort of 8-bit style art prints, using we started out doing just Doctor Who stuff, and now we've expanded into other fandoms that we enjoy. But all of it is literally built square by square, like old school video game art.
How long has that been in operation?
Since about 2010 is when we started. We started very small, just doing a couple little shows. And at one point, we were doing 18 to 20 a year. But we've cut that back significantly now. Now we do about half a dozen of the ones we really like.
And you have this enormous booth when I go see you at cons. I have to ask, is that a bespoke booth that you bring to site and assemble, or is that just provided for you by convention staff?
We build it ourselves. It's grown over the years. So and we reconfigure it for every space because every convention is set up slightly differently. But yeah, it's massive now. It's about 700 or 800 pounds of gear that we
oh my goodness,
travel with. Yeah.
So if you're located in the East Coast like I am and you're appearing at Game One in Los Angeles, how do you get that across country?
That is the only one that we ship our stuff via freight. So we send it by train cross country and then fly to meet it. Most of the other shows we do, because we're based out of Virginia, we do all the way up and down the East Coast and then about as far west as Chicago, because that's within our driving radius.
I know there was the big GalaxyCon convention in Richmond last weekend, and I understand you were there.
Yes, we were. It was a lot of fun, actually. That one it's relatively recent. I think it's been around less than 5 years at this point, but it's now established and people know about it, and it's fairly well known in the area now.
The guest list for that one was phenomenal, because not only did you have William Shatner, but you had a whole bunch of 1990s sitcom stars, everybody who has ever been involved on Blue's Clues, the kids show, and a whole host of other animated voice artists and such. What's it like having sharing convention space with William Shatner?
We've been a lot of conventions that he's been at. So we do a few Star Trek ones as well. I've met him maybe a handful of times, for photos, autos, that kind of thing.
He is 93 years old, but still seems to have the vitality of a guy in his 60s. We should all be so lucky.
Yeah, it's impressive.
So I have your bookmark and another item on my desk. What sort of things do you sell? Are these pins, buttons, ceramic, painted artwork, etc.?
It's mostly poster art, actually, and small prints. We're probably best known for our large posters. On each of those, we take a single Doctor, from Doctor Who, and we do all of the characters from that Doctor's episodes in pixel form, in order, and roughly to scale. So we lay them all out so you can basically relive that Doctor's entire television run all at once. And we pack it full of little Easter eggs and little story moments and things for people to discover. And it's just kind of a real fun graphical representation of that Doctor's era.
And I imagine for a doctor with a longer tenure, like a Tom Baker or William Hartnell, that is a prodigious amount of artwork.
It is. Actually, Tom's, we had to split into two parts because it basically our printer called us up and they're like, they don't make paper in this size. You have to do something. So we split it up roughly between 1970s and 1980s.
And I believe there came a point where Pixel Who became officially licensed by the show itself.
That is true. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but the developers who were working on the BBC's mobile game called Doctor Who Legacy contacted us out of the blue. And they were like, hey, your stuff was sent to us by, it turned out a mutual friend that knew them and knew us. And they were like, would you like to work with us on this and, get your artwork in the game? And at first we kind of went, is this legit? And then we looked into it more, like, actually it is. Yes, we would. And they were wonderful people, really, really great to work with. And our stuff now is canon to the extended universe. Like, they wrote an entire DLC campaign basically around the artwork, explaining, why the characters became little pixel art people. And it was written by George Mann, which is just insane.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Just crazy stuff. And there were some things that we visualized in pixel form for the game, which are now basically the official versions of those things.
So George Mann, the sci-fi writer who has done Doctor Who novels, wrote a campaign tailored around your art.
Yes.
That's got to be a lifetime achievement.
Just wild, right?
And when you say we, who else is involved with Pixel Who apart from yourself?
So my partner, Li Gao, she's sort of the business manager side of the operation. And, we collaborate a lot on all this stuff. She helps me make sure everything looks the way it should. And if I mess up, she tells me and I fix it.
So how long have you been a Doctor Who fan?
Oh, gosh. I was first actually introduced to the show when I was about 8 years old. This was, in the late 80s. And the first episode I ever saw was the Remembrance of the Daleks, the Seventh Doctor story. And that's been a lifelong favorite of mine. But weirdly enough, at the time I was living overseas. So in Cairo, Egypt, it was very, very hard to get video recordings. They just weren't commercially available. We actually had to get videotapes sent to us by my grandparents, who would record it off of Oregon Public Broadcasting and put them in a big box and then mail them to us. And,
now,
these things.
In the late 80s, this is after Sadat. He was assassinated in 81. Mm-hmm. When I was 8. And then you had Mubarak, who I believe was one of your typical dictatorial strongmen.
Oh,
what's
yeah.
it like getting videotapes imported from the U.S. to authoritarian regime halfway across the world?
It wasn't easy. So, like, every video recording coming into the country had to be reviewed by the Egyptian censor's office. So somewhere in some government office somewhere that there's like a bunch of bureaucrats who have watched all our tapes. And I hope we made some new fans that way. We'll never know. Yeah. But one of the funny things was, that recording of Remembrance, when it got to us, it was slightly damaged. So the tape actually snapped midway through episode 3. So it was 10 years before I got to see the end of that show.
Did you ever have somebody from the cultural authorities intercept a tape or not let you receive one of Doctor Who's many less culturally sensitive episodes, a la the Pyramids of Mars, or you ever get episodes taped over by the government saying this is not appropriate for consumption?
Well, if they took anything out of it, I guess we would never really know. But Pyramids of Mars did make it through the screening. So, I guess they put their stamp on that.
I can only imagine what they thought and what their internal logs would have looked like. So how long were you in Egypt?
About 8 years. Yeah. But ironically, while it was really hard to get video recordings, it was really easy to get the novelizations.
And were those sold locally, or were those to be imported as well and read by the authorities?
Those actually were readily available largely because British expats would come to Cairo. They bring their libraries with them. And then sometimes when they left, they wouldn't want to take all those books with them. So they'd offload them to like church or school rummage sales. So they were, Cairo, for some reason, is awash in Target novels.
Huh. Interesting. If I have any Doctor Who literature listeners in Egypt, I would love to hear from you. Please email the show at Doctor Who Literature, Dr. Who Literature at Gmail. So, Nathan, if Remembrance was your first story, but you're only watching the show piecemeal via VHS's received from Oregon Public Television, who were your favorite doctors growing up, and what areas of the show did or did you not have access to?
Well, the Seventh Doctor is a personal favorite. Tom Baker, of course, he was shown a lot on public broadcasting, so we were able to get most of his run sent to us. But there are many doctors that we didn't really get to experience. They don't show, say, the Fifth Doctor much, or the Third, or at least they didn't at the time.
Who are your favorite doctors or companions or characters to depict art-wise?
You know, I like them all. I'm particularly partial to Daleks. Daleks are fun to draw. I'm drawing them since I was a kid, you know, whenever I could.
How long after he was cast did you have a pixel figure for Shooty Gatwick? Because my bookmark here does not go that far.
That's true. We recently updated our multi-doctor pieces to include him and the Fugitive Doctor as well.
Oh, yes, Ruth.
Yeah, we're very excited about his new season.
Yes, Ruth is not on the book. I'll have to get the next version of the book, the next iteration of the bookmark. That is ruthless. Although it does have John Hurt, so that's very good.
Oh, yeah.
What was the first Target novel that you recall reading? I assume that was after you got into the show via Remembrance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Many of the books were available, not in any particular order. So, you know, I just put them up as they were, as I could find them, basically. You know, I think the one that made a huge impression on me as a kid was Inferno. Mm. That one's intense. I mean, it's in the episode itself is pretty intense, too.
No, when I did my top 60 list for L.I. Who last summer, Inferno was right up there in the high top 10, and not number 9 or number 8 either. And the novelization is a bit of an abridgment of the TV in some ways, but I think it's one of Terrence's more vivid ones, especially that cover. It's an incredible set of cover art.
Oh, yeah. The covers on all of these books are a big part of the selling point.
One of the standard questions that I've been asking my guests lately is, what for you is the best Target cover painting? Most folks tend to gravitate, I'll say, towards the same two or three, but there are always some surprise answers. For you, and you do this for a living, obviously, what is the best Target cover art for you?
Oh, gosh, so many good ones. One that I think is really graphically striking, and it stuck with me for years, was the one for Day of the Daleks. Like, it has a, you know, beautiful painting of Dalek on there with sort of a round shape in the background and an Ogron on there. I remember picking that up as a kid and going, ooh, this looks cool. I can't wait to read this.
That's one of the ones where I only have the Pinnacle version, and that has...
Oh, really?
Different cover art with the UNIT spaceship, which of course is infamous because there is no UNIT spaceship until the new series.
They made some odd choices on those covers.
Yeah, those were done in the dark, but that was David Mann, who did some very striking work, even if it was photorealistic. Mm-hmm. And what are your favorite Target books? What are the ones you found yourself reading over and over again the most often?
Gosh, it's been many years since I picked most of these up, so it was actually really fun rereading this one for this podcast, because I read most of it when I was a teenager.
Let's talk about William Hartnell then. So I remember that Hartnell first came to PBS in the New York metropolitan area in 1985, so I can tell you exactly where I was when I first saw Unearthly Child on television. And they screened, there were 17 Hartnells available. We got one a week over the next 4 or 5 months. And I was just grooving on all of them. And then they came back to PBS in 1987, this time in episode format. And this time at age 13, I was prepared with VHS tapes. So I had the entire Hartnell off-air collection on VHS in episode format, except The Rescue, there was a tracking problem and the thing came out unwatchable because there were huge tracking marks across the screen.
Oh, no.
So it was another 2 or 3 years before I was able to get a clean copy of The Rescue. But I was one of the few young teenagers who just found himself enamored of black and white, episodic 1960s live to tape, no budget, shot in a shoebox television, which is a trait shared by very few 13-year-olds, including my own 13-year-old right now. When did you first encounter Hartnell?
It probably would have been around that same time, because actually Doctor Who was family viewing for our whole family. My parents actually watched it when my sisters and I were, before we were born.
Oh, wow.
They actually, well, I'm triplet. So when you have three young children, you know, demanding your attention, and you know, you're just exhausted all the time, they say that sometimes all the energy they had was collapsing in the evening and watching a half hour episode. So when we were old enough, they introduced us to it, and it's become a, you know, central staple of our you know, family for decades.
Oh, that's amazing. And family going so far, again, with Hartnell and especially Troughton, for the 80s and 90s, most of their stuff was lost to us. Mm-hmm. And eventually the recons come about. Was there family viewing of the recons or later on the animations?
That was actually post, you know, post college. So, you know, we were all dispersed by that point, unfortunately. But, you know, I've watched them all myself because I'm probably the biggest fan in the family. But I wouldn't expect, you know, everyone to be watching recons.
I can tell you the very first time that I saw The Savages, I know I would have gotten the book contemporaneous to when it came out, and I would have read it once or twice. Didn't make the biggest impression on me of all the Targets. Plus, I was already 2 or 3 years into fandom at that point, and my initial fandom was starting to wane and be replaced by other things, Star Trek, baseball, girls, not necessarily in that order. So when The Savages came, I was no longer reading the books 3 times in a month. And at that point, I didn't know about off-air soundtracks. Those probably were not widely available in the late 80s, early 90s. The Telesnap reconstructions, I didn't become aware of until the mid-90s when I started going to conventions. Mm-hmm. I was living in Ohio near the Canadian border, and I drove across to visit Stacy Smith. And this is probably 1997. Mm-hmm. And my then partner and I stayed with Stacy and her then partner in suburban Ontario. Late 97, 4 of us sitting on the couch, and I'm like, what do you have that I haven't seen? She had a direct link to a person locally who was doing the Telesnap recon. This is before Loose Cannon. Mm-hmm. So we had a bespoke videotape of The Savages with the dialogue, the transcript printed on screen. Because back then there was no animation. It was just blurry, low-res photos, mm-hmm. hard to watch. And having the words on screen let you know exactly what's going on. So we started watching blurry telesnaps with captions, and both of our partners were asleep long before the end of episode one. But we were sitting there enthralled, leaning forward, really getting into it. I have never enjoyed The Savages so much as I did on that one occasion more than 25 years ago. What's your journey through The Savages?
Probably I first encountered it while reading the old program guide.
The officiating, you know, book, yes.
Yeah, so a lot of the early episodes, that was my first exposure to them, because all we have was, you know, the written description. The recordings don't exist anymore. After that, probably same in the mid-90s with the advent of the internet, access to the telesnaps and the audio recordings were a lot easier to obtain. And of course, the novelization I read back then also didn't make a huge impression on me. I don't think as a kid I found it terribly exciting. But coming back to it now, it was really interesting because I think I'm getting different things out of it than I would have at the time.
It's not one of those books. I mean, because it is an episode shot in a small TV studio at a time where the producers were actively trying to get rid of their popular lead, the Doctor spends most of the second half of the story strapped to a gurney, groaning and mumbling. Mm-hmm. And because it's shot in Lime Grove D or whatever the studio was that week, it's mostly the same three sets, which means that large swaths of the novelization take place in the same three rooms. So there's not a whole lot of sense of exploration or momentum or action. To use the damning with faint praise that was given to the very first Star Trek pilot, it's a very cerebral book.
Mm-hmm.
And Ian Stewart Black, bless him, very good script writer. His prose style is not my favorite of all the Target writers. This is not exactly Terrence Dick's territory. Now that you're reading this book almost 40 years after its publication, how does the book work for you now?
Like you said, the writing style is very utilitarian, and it's a very talky script. So, yeah, I wouldn't say it's great literature. It gets the job done.
What for you are some of the high points of the TV story or the book?
Well, yeah, what I found most interesting about this one was, like, coming to it now. Obviously, the fandom has a different kind of impression of it than perhaps the viewers did at the time, right? I think generally now it's regarded as possibly one of the most racist episodes in Doctor Who in certain circles.
You're aware, I guess, of the original title of the story?
Yes, indeed. I guess we have to talk about that, don't we? It's so when it was originally written, it was entitled The White Savages.
As if that was supposed to be a shocking and unusual thing that would grab the audience's attention.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can understand the intent there, but I'm very glad they didn't go with that title.
Absolutely, yes.
But yeah, what's interesting is I've been looking into the background of it and how it was intended to be received and how it was received at time of transmission. Apparently, Ian Stewart Black, when he wrote it, perceived this to be an anti-racist tale, also anti-capitalist and anti-colonialist, which unfortunately, due to some kind of questionable production decisions, like having many of the actors in blackface, does not come across.
It is funny how things that are intended to be progressive for their era come across as the opposite of that when you watch them in the harsh light of 2024. Even for me, a lot of RTD's episodes, which are meant to be progressive, come across exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. And they often leave a sour taste in my mouth, especially Torchwood Children of Earth, which plays very differently in the QAnon era that we're living in now.
Oh,
but
yes.
looking at the intention of the production team, you have the Doctor and company standing up for this group of people that are being stolen in order to make the lights go on for the quote-unquote elders. And you have Stephen is left behind to be king of this planet.
Mm-hmm.
How does this play today? What could the author have done differently to make this a little more palatable to the 2024 eye and ear?
Well, yeah, some of the production decisions that you know really affect how this thing is received, unfortunately, I think fall on Christopher Barry, which is unfortunate because he's a very skilled and prolific Doctor Who director. He did a lot of really well received episodes like The Demons and Brain of Morbius, the original Dalek story. You know.
Yes.
But yeah, unfortunately, I think in the time that it was made, some of these choices may not have been strange, but now looking back, they're kind of hard to excuse.
Yeah, there's blackface in almost everything for the 1960s, and I'm sure you know this. The one of the original proposals for the Patrick Troughton Doctor was to have him in blackface.
Mm-hmm. Again, glad they didn't go that route.
Exactly. So this is not William Hartnell's finest hour, because again, this was one of a long run of stories in season three when the producers were trying to get rid of him and sideline him, going from Dalek's Master Plan all the way up through 10th Planet. But when the Doctor is sidelined, it gives the companions a chance for things to do. This is Peter's story, and it's Jackie Lane's last full story as Dodo, because she is unceremoniously non-renewed 2 weeks into the very next episode, War Machines. Was this, in book form, the first time you came across Stephen and Dodo? What kind of impression did they make on you then? And how do they come across in this story?
They actually get some of the strongest characterizations in this book. In fact, I thought Stephen came off very well, and Dodo gets a lot of action. She stands up for herself. She pushes back on people who are trying to, you know, capture her or force her into certain situations. I think they both do very well in this story.
The main impetus of the story, where our characters find out what's really going on, is because Dodo gets bored during a guided tour and sneaks off and discovers the evil. Dodo, when I was coming of age in online fandom in the 90s, the word Dodo was almost a bad word. And there was some guy who actually made a website, a very sarcastic website, mocking Dodo's entire essence. Not sure if that's fair to Jackie Lane, because, you know, you're hired for a regular job. Your accent is taken away from you during week two. You're given scripts where your character does very stupid things, like in Celestial Toymaker, even though Jackie Lane does not produce the show or write her own lines. Is this one of her better outings in Doctor Who?
I'd say it is. Unfortunately, so much of her work doesn't survive. We don't have a lot to judge her on, except for maybe, what is it, The Ark, and a little bit of War Machines. Most of her other stories just are fragmentary.
We are lucky to still have all of Gunfire, which is also high atop my top 20.
Oh, Gunfire.
But then there's also the surviving fragments of Celeste. Now, I've heard Lee talk about Talons of Wang Chiang, and she has a great presentation on that, taking it apart and destroying it. I can't imagine that Celestial Toymaker goes over very well either for that same reason.
Probably not, unfortunately.
And that's the story where Dodo infamously tries to keep telling her opponents how to defeat her in the games, which would result in her death. So, again, not the best use of Jackie Lane's talents.
Yeah, so I'd forgotten, before I reread this book, that it was Stephen's last story, and he ends up actually becoming a rebel leader and a planetary ruler by the end of this thing, and proves himself very capable.
Peter Purvis has said in interviews that he thinks it would be funny to revisit, because he thinks that Stephen would be a terrible leader and that power would go to his head and he would become a dictator in training.
That would be interesting. Have any of the novels or Big Finish come back to that?
I know Peter Purvis has done a lot of Big Finish, and I can't consume all of Big Finish's product, but I don't think they've ever done a post-Savages Stephen story. And I don't think any of the novelizations – I don't think any of the original novels covered Stephen post this story. So I'm not sure that's a thing that's ever been answered.
I'm amazed that there's a hole that Big Finish has not plugged yet.
Well, now that Peter Purvis is of a certain age, he could easily play Stephen as an older man. And we could do a whole four-story box set on Stephen being a terrible leader. I just like the character. I think Peter Purvis is very charismatic, and it's a great performance. And even when I was a kid, I was taken with him in, you know, The Chase or in The Gunfighters, where he gets to sing. So I don't want to picture him as a bad leader. I want to keep my happy memories of him.
Yeah, there are some other interesting characters that do get a little bit of characterization in this. Nanina, the savage girl that forms a relationship with one of the guards, she gets a lot more to do than one would expect.
Yes, and she's prominently featured in some of the surviving telesnaps as well, in her best of Raquel Welch 100,000 BC getup. What are some other takeaways from either the TV story or the novelization for you?
Well, one thing I found that was really interesting was this is one of the very first instances where William Hartnell's doctor takes a stance against the society that they encounter and goes, "You guys are terrible, and I'm going to oppose you. And you're no better than the Daleks." I think he even says that.
Oh, wow.
To them, and goes, "What you're doing is wrong, and I'm going to stop you." That's probably, that becomes a pillar of the Doctor's character from then onwards. And it's probably historically significant that this is one of the very first points at which that happens.
I know our mutual friend Graham Burke has said that the big moment where the Hartnell Doctor becomes the Doctor we know today is the last cliffhanger in War Machines, where the camera is taking the place of the War Machine and is marching forward, and it's a POV shot of Hartnell with his lapels gripped, staring into the camera defiantly. And that's kind of a moment where the Doctor becomes a hero. I bring that up because that episode was written by the same guy, Ian Stewart Black.
Mm-hmm.
So he did, of course, these back-to-back stories. Is it fair to say that without Ian Stewart Black, maybe the Doctor never becomes the figure that we now know today, who topples entire governments just by a stern look?
That's quite possible. I mean, we may owe him a debt of gratitude in that regard.
One of the other things that we like to do on this show is we occasionally play games. I haven't played this one in a while, but I think you're going to be a very good candidate for a game of 20 questions. I will briefly go over the ground rules because I haven't played this on the show in a few months. I have selected at random from the archives from the randomizer.net one Doctor Who story between 1963 and 2023. Using a series of 20 yes or no questions, you are going to guess which story I have picked out of the entire 60-year run of the show. Are you ready to proceed?
Okay.
So, if you are ready, Nathan, what is your first question?
Is this a classic series episode?
Yes, it is a classic series episode, and that's great because you've now eliminated pretty much half the show right there. Halfway to the answer.
All right. Is it from the 1960s?
I see you're doing the Graham Burke method of playing 20 questions and going in rigid chronological order. I think the record on this show is 5 questions. You might actually break that. So your question is it from the 60s? Yes, it is a 1960s story.
All right. Does it feature the original TARDIS crew of Ian, Barbara, and Susan?
No, it does not. The record on 20 questions for the most yes answers in a row is 5. I thought you were going to get there, but that was a bit of a granular question. No, it is not the original companions.
Okay.
Question number 4.
Is it a historical episode?
No, it is not a historical. Which wipes out for you a good chunk of the early to mid-60s?
It does. It does.
This is question 5. You can take a wild swing and throw out a guess and see if you can tie the record, or you can go methodically.
I don't think I'm quite close enough yet.
I will say nobody has ever failed this game. Bill Evenson came close, and ChatGPT did fail, but ChatGPT is not a person, so no human has ever actually failed this game. I think you'll get it within 5 more questions, but we'll see if I'm right.
Probably.
Question number five.
All right, let's see here. I think of a question that will eliminate some options here.
No pressure, no pressure at all. There is no penalty for failure.
Does it take place primarily on an alien planet?
No, it does not take place primarily on an alien planet.
Interesting.
That's three no's in a row, by the way. So we're narrowing it down.
We are. Let's see. Oh, I guess I should ask, is it a first Doctor story?
Yes, it is a first Doctor story.
Yeah, because otherwise it could also have been a second.
And it's not, that's true. Not a historical, not an alien planet. So there's not too many first Doctor stories left. In fact, if you go story by story, you might get it within 20 questions, but I'm sure you don't want to go the long way around.
That would probably take a while. Let's see. Got my little reference guide here.
Is it the Fissier book or a different reference guide?
Well, it's over there, so I'm just grabbing my phone here.
Ah.
Okay.
I played this game on my show once, and I had a middle of, I think I got it an 8, which is middle of the pack. You're at number 7 now.
Okay. Is Vicky in this story?
No, Vicky is not in the story.
Okay.
So that eliminates most of season 2.
It does.
I will say that of all the times I've played this game on the show, I have never had the story of the week be the story that came up in the randomizer for 20 questions. But this is one of the few times that we've gotten a story with the same doctor. So it's a Hartnell book and a Hartnell 20 questions. So you're lucky there. This is a groundbreaking moment for Doctor Who literature.
Mm-hmm. All right. How many have I got left?
This is question 8, your next one.
Okay.
I mean, the earliest story that it can be is The Rescue, because that was the first story without the original set of companions, but we're eliminating historicals and alien planets.
Right.
And Vicky. So right now, actually, the earliest story that it can be at all is going to be The Massacre. And it can't be The Massacre because it's
because it's historical. Yeah.
Right. So we're looking basically at only the last half of season 3 and the beginning of season 4.
That is true.
I like the way you're narrowing this down methodically. A lot of folks go pogo sticking around trying to find something that sticks. You're working it out.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of a good question that will eliminate more of these. Okay, so it can't be that.
Trying to play along with you. I think there are only 2 serials left that it can be.
Yeah.
Because no alien planet, no historical.
Does it take place? Sorry.
No Barbara, no Vicky. Go ahead.
Is the setting contemporary?
No, it doesn't take place in the 1960s when it was shot.
Okay.
I think there's only one choice left.
I think so. I think as far as I can tell, that narrows it down to the 10th planet.
You are correct. It is the 10th planet. You got it in 9, which is very good for a first-time player.
Whew.
All right. That was great. Yeah, 10th Planet, the book is one of the earlier Target novels, so we've already covered that on this show. In publication order, we're now up to 1986. And this is when a lot coming out all at once. So 1986 and 1987 were great years to get Hartnell in print. And that, of course, coincides when I first started watching him on TV. So I became a Hartnell fan indecently young. Not too many teenagers in the 80s are going around being William Hartnell fans.
Yeah, definitely
for
not.
You, if you were to try to create a new Doctor Who fan, if you were going to take someone that you think would really enjoy the show and give them their first Target book, would this be a good choice for somebody's first Doctor Who novelization ever?
Oh, the Savages?
Yes.
I don't think so. It's not terribly riveting, and I'm not sure what someone coming to it cold would really get out of it.
I think it's an interesting way of unlocking the show's past, because the Doctor is recognized by Jano and the Elders, and they make reference to his previous adventures. So when you read the book, the early chapters, you get a sense that the Doctor is an important person who has a really good back catalog. But yeah, the prose doesn't really carry me along, that's for sure.
In fact, the Elders really butter him up. They're like, "We've been watching you, your travels. You're a very important person. We've been looking forward to meeting you." And that's not the kind of reception he normally gets.
Which begs the question, if they've been watching all of his stories on TV, how do they not know his name? And how do they not know that he has companions?
Yeah, they didn't expect them at all.
I think that's Ian Stewart Black not necessarily being familiar with the show's format when he got the commission. Let's talk about the cover, Arthur. This is a pretty striking one. I always like my good black cover and black spine. But you have Frederick Jaeger, who comes back to several other Doctor Who stories, and you've got a pretty good look at Hartnell there. What do you think of this particular cover painting? It's one of the better ones. David McAllister was doing a lot of cover art around this time in the mid to late 80s.
It's a very, you know, the likenesses are very strong. I'm not sure it conveys much of the content. It's very abstract.
Like,
if I didn't know anything about the plot of this book, this cover tells me nothing.
Yeah, you're not really sure who Frederick Jaeger's character is supposed to be either. He doesn't look very elderish. Yeah. He could be a savage for all we know, because it is the title of the book.
Yeah. In fact, I think I remember as a kid, you know, picking this up, kind of examining the cover and going, huh, this title doesn't seem to match its image.
Let me ask you another cover art then. Are you familiar with the cover of the Caves of Androzani novelization?
Which version?
The original Target painting from, would have been, I guess, 1984 or 85.
I have to go to my library here and pull it out or look it up here. Can't quite recall what that looks like.
If you can grab it off your shelf and show me the cover, if it's the right one, I have a question for you about that cover art. It's not the later blue spine, but it's the purple one. Most of it is taken up with Shara's Jek.
Oh yes, with a sort of a orange explosion kind of behind him.
Yes. So there is an image on that cover, and it's above Shara's Jek.
Yeah, it's like a face in the glow there.
Story-wise, what is that face supposed to be? What do you think?
Unclear. I mean, in the context of the episode, you know, it could be Perry, you know? He obsesses about her a lot. Maybe he's reminiscing about what he used to look like. It's a very sort of androgynous kind of face.
I can't really quite make Nicola Bryant and all that. I thought when I was a kid, I thought that this was what the injury, but I've heard another explanation, and I'm not sure that I buy the explanation because the face is wrong. I've heard an explanation that's supposed to be the Doctor's face mid-regeneration. Peter into Colin. I don't quite see it, though.
Interesting theory.
But you think it could be Perry as well. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm just thinking
about... I don't think Nicola Bryant ever got on any of the novelization covers, which is a shame.
Did she not? Oh, that's surprising.
Unless she was on some of the blue spines later on. I only have the 80s cover paintings. I don't think she ever made any of them.
Yeah, she's not on the later cover version either.
So, Nathan, where can we find you and Pixel Who Online. And for those of you who are not at conventions in the States where you are, how can they acquire some of your excellent stuff?
Well, if you can find us at conventions, we're frequently there. But if you're looking for us online, our website is www.pixelwho.com. That will take you to all of our stuff. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, a variety of other spots.
And that's at Pixel Who?
It is, except for, I think, Instagram, which is at Pixel Who Art, because someone took our handle and is sitting up.
Oh, that's not fair. And you're still hanging on Twitter, huh, even after all that's been happening?
We use it very sparingly now.
Yeah, I finally pulled the plug on January 1st. Everything Musk was doing was a bridge too far, and I finally said, I can't be a party to this.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
So anything else that we can talk about, Doctor Who-wise, before I let you get back on with your day?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have, I think, high hopes for the future of the show. They just dropped a trailer, I think today or late yesterday, for the new season. And it looks phenomenal.
I have not seen that yet.
Oh, go look it up after this. It looks really, really, really fun. And I think it's going to bring in new viewership. So I think the future of the program is secure.
That is one of the downsides of having a 9-to-5 desk job, and that I was not aware of this dropping. And one of the downsides of being on Twitter is that I usually would have gotten push notifications or DMs saying, you need to watch this right away. And I've lost access to all that now. So, yeah, I have shown my 13-year-old a couple of the newer episodes, and she likes them. Doesn't love them, but likes them. So I'm going to try and watch as much of the new series with her as I can. And it's dropping on Friday evenings in the States, 7 p.m. Eastern time. So we'll be able to watch them on Disney come out starting on May 11th, 2 months from now. So there is a new. So I'm excited for this new trailer. Then that's good.
Oh yeah, you know, Disney I think is really pulling out the stops on promoting this thing, which is great to see.
They were giving out promotional posters at Galley last month, so I have one of those. Although it didn't quite survive intact in my suitcase, got kind of crumpled up. But I do have. All right, Nathan, thank you so much for joining us. This was a lot of fun. Thanks for playing 20 questions and being a good sport. This episode will be released in 2 days as you and I are having this conversation, and I will make sure to tag you on all the socials.
Excellent. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks again. Have a great night.
You too.
Doctor Who, The Savages, by Ian Stewart Black. Televised as The Savages. Teleplay by Ian Stewart Black. Televised in May and June, 1966. Paperback release date, September 11th, 1986. Target book number, 109. Cover artist, David McAllister. Landing on a distant planet, the Doctor confidently announces to his companions that the TARDIS has brought them to an age of great advancement, peace, and prosperity. The Doctor's calculations seem to be confirmed when the travelers are greeted by Jano and the Elders, who take them on a tour of their city, a haven of beauty, harmony, and friendship, set in a wilderness inhabited by tribes of savages. But the security of the city is founded on one deadly and appalling secret. Soon, the Doctor and his friends discover that it is not only outside the city walls that savages dwell. Oh, goody. This is a short one. Only 121 pages of text. That's a throwback. We've been getting away from short books in the Target line lately as our journey through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations, put out by Target Books in publication order from 1973 onward, takes us into the mid-1980s. Sometimes it's a relief to have a shorter book that just tells its story, gets in and gets out, in crisp, clear prose. And 11 chapters, not 12 like a standard Terence Dicks novelization. Unfortunately, this is not one of those books with crisp, clear prose. Ian Stewart Black wrote 3 pretty solid Doctor Who serials across seasons 3 and 4, but prose is probably not his strong suit. Check this. paragraph 1, page 7. Long before the estimated time of arrival of the TARDIS, the Doctor was looking particularly pleased with himself. He had been juggling with a number of the intricate dials on the banks of instruments that ranged across the TARDIS's control console, making calculations, adjusting a multi-computer, and coming to conclusions that brought a dry smile to his time-weathered features. And then, bottom of page 7 into top of page 8, quote, they looked up to examine the scanner. This would be their first sight of the planet on which they had arrived, always a moment of excitement, no matter how many times such arrivals had been experienced before. All one sentence. Hoo boy! A lot of the Hartnell novelizations not written by Terence Dix or David Whittaker or Ian Martyr are going to be like this. Sorry. I promise that I'm not going to devote this whole essay to kicking sadistically at a book that's 38 years old and out of print for more than 30 years now. One more, though. Page 13. He, the Doctor, turned to retrace his steps to the TARDIS very briskly. End quote. So, there's a lot to unpack. Run-on sentences, too many adverbs, no real style. Overwritten? Possibly because the author thought that these books are literary and need to sound like that? Of course, read YA or middle grade books today and they're not like this at all. So instead of beating up on the prose, we do have to finish the book, let's chart the differences from TV. Chapter 1, Dodo's TV line questioning Stephen's manhood is not in the book. The Doctor's quote-unquote reacting vibrator on TV is in the book merely a calculator. So that's two things to like about the book. The prose may be overwrought, but at least the cringiest TV moments are not here. One thing I like about the book is that the chapter titles are all taken directly from TV quotes. Andrew Smith did this in the Full Circle novelization a few years ago in publication time. Here, the chapter 2 title, You Have Made Me Look Very Grand, is not the exact TV quote, where Hartnell on TV works in a reference to the quote, Dear Ladies. And of course, Ian Stuart Black couldn't have known when he referenced the quote, One Simple Discovery that elevated the elders, but he basically invented every bad internet ad of the 21st century. One simple trick to curing belly fat. One weird trick. You don't trust that line on the savages, and you don't trust that line on the internet either. While the prose isn't very good, you can see why Ian Stuart Black was immediately brought back to write the next TV story after this one. The novelization, being so faithful to the TV script, shows real storytelling skills, especially with the intercut scenes in Chapter 3 between Jano hinting to the Doctor about how the city achieves such great advantages without fully giving away the dark secret, and the viewer learning that dark secret before the Doctor does, with Dodo observing the city's guards taking a quote-unquote savage as hostage, and with mad scientist Senta discussing the ruthless transfer of life force from those savages to the city elders. What's in the book that's not on TV? Senta making banal complaints about how rough Tuesdays are, a funny line but a bit out of place in this civilization. The savage Wilder being named, which doesn't happen until deep into episode 2 on TV, and Senta darkly hinting about the city's intended plans for Stephen and Dodo. Page 37, Senta, different in other ways. Exorce, yes, but I can't quite say exactly how. Back to Senta, we shall analyze that soon enough. That last line would have fit very well in the episode as televised, as it prefigures what the elders will soon do to the Doctor. But the episode 1 cliffhanger line at the end of chapter 3, the approaching savage fills Dodo with quote-unquote alarm. No. Alarm isn't for cliffhangers. Terror? Horror? The worst fear of her life? Yes. Terence wouldn't end a cliffhanger scene with so mild a word. This is also a good time to talk about the furious pacing of the savages. Chapter 4 is made up of 11 sections, 10 paragraph breaks, and 13 pages. The online episode transcript has the corresponding episode 2 material as 14 discrete scenes. And remember what I've been saying all along about how television is made at the BBC. These episodes were shot at Riverside. I think I mentioned Lime Grove D when talking to Nathan earlier, but that wouldn't happen again until the Moon Base in production season 4. Still, Riverside is a smaller space, and episodes shot live to tape with 4 or 5 video cameras, just as in Lime Grove. To stage 14 scenes in about 10 minutes of story time requires a lot of planning, furious camera movement, and a lot of vision mixing up in the gallery. Directed by Christopher Barry, who did such groundbreaking work on the Daleks not even 3 years earlier in TV time, this may be even more technically complex than the Daleks in terms of camera movement and shot changes, even if the script isn't as good. And we don't know, of course, if there were any technically complex and stunning individual shots like you get in the earlier story, but the point is, when you read the novelization and remember how TV was made in 1966, it makes you really, really want to travel back in time to May of that year and buy that vision mixer a few pints. Chapter 5 is the pivotal point of the book, when the Doctor figures out what's going on and first takes a stand against the Elders and their hideous practice. Nathan and I discussed earlier that this material was meant to be progressive for its time, but would possibly be handled more sensitively today. But you can't listen to the following material and not hear it as, quote-unquote, woke. Doctor Who? Getting political in 1966? Say it ain't so. Chapter 6, where the Doctor furiously tells off Jano to his face, rather than a mere guard captain as in Chapter 5, is more of the same, but even better, as the Doctor directly compares the Elders to his worst enemies ever, and thanks to Nathan for pointing this out to me, let's play the clip.
We do not understand you, Doctor. You, who have accepted our honors gladly, how can you condemn this great artistic and scientific civilization because of a few wretched barbarians?
So your rewards are only for the people that agree with you?
No, of course not. But if you are going to oppose us...
Oppose you? Indeed, I am going to oppose you. Just in the same way that I oppose the Daleks or any other menace to common humanity.
I'm sorry you take this attitude, Doctor. It is most unscientific. You are standing in the way of human progress.
Human progress, sir? How dare you call your treatment of these people progress?
They are hardly people, Doctor. They are not like us.
I fail to see the difference.
Do you not realize that all progress is based on exploitation?
Exploitation, indeed! This, sir, is protracted murder!
We have achieved a very great deal merely by the sacrifice of a few savages.
The sacrifice of even one soul is far too great. We must put an end to this inhuman practice.
You leave me no choice. Take him away, Captain. And tell Senta that we have an emergency. I shall be sending him special instructions.
More changes from TV. The fate of Avon and Flower is left open-ended in Chapter 5. On TV, we see them being let off with light guns, and that's their final mention. Avon will be back as Captain Turner in The Invasion, at least, though that was way back in Target Book number 98 for us on this podcast. Chapter 6, and the Doctor's being subject to the transference, slims down the TV material a bit and turns it into the episode 2 cliffhanger, which Black seems ambivalent about as he buries the moment mid-chapter on page 73, well over halfway through the book, which doesn't leave much text for the final 2 episodes. There's a seeming blooper on TV in episode 3 where Steven says twice to Exorce, "Come on, soldier boy, what are you frightened of?" in the same scene. But that may not be a blooper after all, because the book, which is likely based on the rehearsal script, does have that line twice. But there is a good line on TV, not in the book, so likely added by the story editor, after a random savage tells Exorce where to find Steven and Dodo in the caves. On TV only, he defends himself to Nonino, with the classic and ever feeble excuse of the collaborator, "But he would have taken me!" The episode 3 cliffhanger also falls mid-chapter, mid-section even, within chapter 8, on page 94, not even given the benefit of a paragraph break. Episode 3 is by far the most short change for the book, taking up parts of just 22 pages, compared to the episode 1 material's luxurious 35 pages. This is standard for the Targets at least. The funny thing is, of course, that nothing is missing from TV's episode 3 that's not in the book. It's just written efficiently, if dryly. One of the few memorable passages in the book comes on page 95, at the resolution to that cliffhanger, in early episode 4. Quote, She turned to see the door opening, and beyond it the outside world with air she could breathe, and the scrubland, the rocky land in which the savages lived and hid. It seemed like paradise. Chapter 9 shows Dodo and Chal, the savages' leader, bringing the doctor to safety in the caves, Stephen expertly holding off the elders, and discontent in the savages' caves with an argument between the compassionate Nanina and the impulsive, impetuous, insubordinate, and churlish Tor. If this all seems familiar, it's because this is here in the fourth-to-last Hartnell serial, a well-worn set of tropes. Simple good versus evil morality plays, like Galaxy 4. Arguments between strong women and weak men in caves, like the Tribe of Gum episodes of An Unearthly Child. And the male companion serving as action hero and de facto series lead, while William Hartnell gets a virtual week off, on set and before the cameras, but not saying anything, like in select episodes of Marco Polo, or The Dalek Invasion of Earth, or The Dalek's Master Plan. Shannon Patrick Sullivan, on the page for this story, on A Brief History of Time Travel, writes, quote, William Hartnell was struggling with his ability to memorize dialogue, and so, on May 27th, he was effectively given a respite for Episode 3, in which the Doctor had no lines. Hartnell instead worked with Frederick Jaeger to incorporate the Doctor's mannerisms into Jano's personality. Unusually, the first 8 scenes of Part 4 were recorded immediately after Part 3 was completed. And the Doctor has no lines in those scenes either, I would add. The long sidelining and eventual departure of Hartnell from the show is a constant theme in this Season 3 production block, The Mythmakers Through the Smugglers. For more on this, dip into our back catalog, as Jim Sangster and I went through that production block story by story in Episode 101A. A couple of good lines worth noting in Chapter 10. Page 109, quote, "It was marvelous to have the Doctor back again, although he did speak sometimes as though every word he said was like laying down the law." And Terence style, Black does end Chapter 10 with an invented cliffhanger moment that's not really on TV. Exors, having escaped captivity by the savages but having been shamed by Nanina, who'd helped save his life, bursts into an emergency Elders Council meeting and is asked if Jano has betrayed his own people. Page 117, quote, "Exors guessed the whole of their civilization depended on his answer." End of chapter. Spoiler alert, it does. Nicely done. Chapter 11 is Stephen's departure from Doctor Who, the audio from which I played in Episode 101A, so will not play again here. According to Shannon Patrick Sullivan, when Black was commissioned to write this, it was already known that Stephen was leaving, so this departure sequence was likely Black's own writing, not stapled onto the script later on by Jerry Davis, the way that, say, Romana's departure was not in Stephen Gallagher's draft of Warrior's Gate, or that Sarah Jane's departure was not in the Bob Baker, Dave Martin draft of The Hand of Fear. Chapter 11, then, is pretty faithful to the TV, except the Doctor has a line in the book, "With a little help from my friends," which, assuming it comes from the 1967 Sgt. Pepper track of the same name, wouldn't have been known to Black writing these scripts a year earlier, in the beginning of 1966, but which he probably added for the novelization with 20 years hindsight. Also on TV, it's randomly Chal who identifies Stephen as the planet's new leader. In the book, that role is properly reassigned to the Doctor to identify Stephen as the planet's new leader. "I think you have the man here," the Doctor says. In closing, this is the first of 3 Ian Stewart Black novelizations. Next up will be the second Doctor adventure, The Macroterror, a very similar story about the dark secret at the heart of paradise, and which ends in the exact same way, with a control room dismantled with bare hands. And last from Black will be the eventual novelization of The War Machines. Both of those books will diverge radically from their TV parents, one much more so than the other, but both more than The Savages, which is a very faithful scene-by-scene retelling. This is Black's first target, so the painful faithfulness can be expected. It's also painfully dry, but at least The Savages is short and doesn't overstay its welcome, which is just as well because the next book after this one is not short. and in fact will be given a special name right there on the cover, a bumper volume. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, you've been asked for him to come back. I've been begging him to come back, and he is back. Conrad Westmus, fresh off of some recent Big Finish releases, is re-rejoining us to talk about that bumper volume, a Patrick Troughton story that we have all come to know and love and respect much more so over the years. Join Conrad and me in a week's time as we delve into Doctor Who, Fury from the Deep. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Doctor Who Literature. The executive producer is David Barsky. The producers are Jim Sangster and yours truly. This week's episode was written by me and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Nathan from Pixel Who. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.